Welcome. My name is Rui Frias. I'm the director of the Museum of History. Welcome to Happy Hour with the Historian. It's the last one of our season here of 2022, but no worries. We return next year for our 10th season. It features some pretty amazing speakers. We're going to be talking about the Beatles in Florida. We've got Gary Francis Powers Jr. coming here talking. He's a stud pilot in his own right, but he's going to be talking about the Cold War and his father and that famous U-2 flight. Dr. Martin Luther King in St. Augustine, the people of Wheaton Island, the memories of a Tuskegee Airman nurse, and who may or may not be in the audience tonight, and how in the world did Walt pull the wool over everybody's eyes and built Walt Disney in your world. So we'll be talking about that. But it all starts January 12th with a history of our own sunken gardens. And so you'll be getting emails, and we'll be actually announcing and releasing the entire schedule next week. So to make sure you get a seat to these, become a member. The one tonight proves that fact because it's sold out in about 4 hours. So members get first dibs at the tickets, so make sure you become a member. They also are great Christmas gifts, stocking stuffers. We've got plenty of membership brochures at the front desk, so there's no excuse not to grab one on the way out. So I'd like to give some special thanks tonight to folks like the Huff Family Foundation, who sponsor our education programs, the City of St. Petersburg, Southern Roots Realty, Pilot Bank, the Baynard Charitable Trust, the Willis Family, the Tampa Bay Times, Hennessy Construction, Florida Humanities, and the title sponsor of our Happy Hour series, UPC Insurance. All right, so our speaker tonight is a native Floridian, born here in St. Pete in 1963, with family roots stretching to New Hampshire, Pittsburgh, and beyond. He's the grandson of hotel builder and developer Amir Vinoy Lochner, and is a graduate of Pennsylvania's Grove City College, where he earned a degree in history and economics. An antique dealer since 1987, he specializes in military antiques and historical Americana. He's also a writer, having had articles published in journals in the US and UK, focusing on what the UK's Military History Monthly magazine described as the intersection of military and social history. Additionally, he was featured for several years on Pittsburgh's Hidden Treasures, a PBS roadshow event. He's authored two books, one of which is a family history of the Vinoy Park Hotel, consultant to several museums, and don't worry, I already have some things for him to do for us here. He also does appraisal work for institutions and estates. He and his partner Tara have turned their backs on the snowy north and now reside in Pinellas Point, only 2 miles from where he was born. Ladies and gentlemen, Niles James Lochner.
Be me. So I have a general outline I'm going to try and follow tonight, but the things that we're going to talk about were kind of family stories and anecdotes, and I don't know how well they fit into, let's just say it's very narrative. Not lots of facts and figures. That stuff I don't find amazingly interesting as a historian. I'm more interested in why and the behind-the-scenes things and things that happen to the regular people. So that's kind of the approach I'm going to take. I know I will stray from this outline. I probably should just throw it away, but I'm going to keep it here. So, when I was a teenager, for reasons I'm not sure about, my folks sent me to a Baptist boarding school, and we were not Baptists. One of the things that I did learn there was how to do a three-part sermon with an introduction and a conclusion and an altar call at the end. So that is kind of the format we're going to follow, but we won't do the altar call part. Not tonight, anyway. I love the Vinoy. It's very hard to describe what kind of a part that plays in your character and in your family when you have a kind of a monument like that, that's a piece of you and has one of your family names on it. It's very strange. And I've had a lot of people ask how that feels, and I probably gave a different answer every time, and I wasn't lying. It's just very hard to put into words. We almost lost it. When you get the opportunity later. There's some things over on the table there, and one of them is a shirt that just has a picture of the Vinoy and it says Save the Vinoy. And there was a point where my family was sure that it was done. The Sereno was done and the Vinoy was going to be next. And that was a real bummer. But it did not happen, and it's a great thing. When it was built in the 20s, I feel like it was an anchor for this city. It was a it was kind of a focal point, and I feel like it heralded sort of a new era for the city. If you've been here long enough, you know that there came a time where the city, it had some hard times. It in the 70s and 80s and 90s, it was pretty tough. At that point, I was in New Hampshire. We came down every year to visit both of my grandmothers. My grandmother Lochner lived right across from the Vinoy at 532 Beach Drive in a house that we thought of in the last 20 years as the Jimmy Buffett bed and breakfast. That has kind of changed. It looks more like a house now. But so every time we visited, there was this beautiful big place there. And for most of my memory, it was just closed. Very strange. And my dad, my grandmother, and other people in the family would tell me all about the amazing things that happened there in this place, what a great place this was. In the 90s, which is, gosh, 30 years ago, when it was reopened, you could kind of start to see that it was going to be an anchor again. And I can tell, I worked there when it was renovated and reopened 30 years ago. And I can tell you that the neighborhoods around it were not good, and you could almost call it a pioneer experiment that someone put a lot of money behind, a fellow named Fred Guest, that had faith in the area and hoped to make a bit of money on the condos. But if it wasn't for him, I think it would be gone. So I owe him a debt of gratitude. I haven't seen him in 30 years, but if he's listening, thanks, Fred. The social life of St. Petersburg kind of revolved around that hotel when it was open in the kind of roaring 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s. I don't know if you know how the hotel business worked at that time in the South, because there was no air conditioning. So the hotels closed in April or May, and they did not open again until Christmas time. So when the hotel would reopen for the season in December, the lights in that tower would be lit, and they would stay lit the whole time the place was open. And it was kind of a sign that everything is back to normal now. You know, we've got the good weather, we're going to have a good time down here. And then the summers always came afterwards. But that cycle was kind of a problem in the end. An enormous place like that to be retrofitted with air conditioning and things like that is just a ridiculous expense, and there was no way that was going to happen. Little motels really picked up the slack. I always felt that servicemen that came home from World War II that had been all over the world or from the Korean War realized that they could go all kinds of places. And so everything kind of began to sort of cascade down. And it was a sort of a sad end. It, as you probably know, became a place where people broke in. I think homeless folks were living in it. My brother, whose name is Vinoy, by the way.
Wow.
Try living with that name. It's like being named Don Cesar and living on St. Pete. He went in there, and there was a group of people they had set up a volleyball net in the ballroom, and it was a volleyball court. And of course, my dad was just, he didn't even want to know it. It upset him so much. I never knew my grandfather, Imer Vinoy Lochner. He was dead 2 years before I was born. I'm the only one of the grandchildren that didn't know him. And actually, though, I've ended up being the family history guy, so I'm not sure if it's the not knowing that makes me want to know. I'm not sure. But he's an interesting character. So basically, my three-part sermon to you tonight. We're going to talk about the Vinoy at the end, save the best for last. But the two people that are the most important people in the development of this place, I'll just try and give you a brief bio about, while remembering that you're not my family, and I can't go into too much detail or you glaze over. So, this picture, this is not actually a family picture, but what this is kind of demonstrating is the state of the oil business in the 1800s. That is actually a little refinery in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. So Imer Vinoy Lochner is my grandfather. My great-grandfather, I love this phrase, the founder of the feast, and it was actually Charles Dickens that wrote it about Scrooge. I don't think my great-grandfather was Scrooge, but he was the founder of the feast, for sure. He was born just before the Civil War in Pennsylvania. I wanted to say that the name of the town was Middle of Nowhere because that's what it should have been, but it was actually called Six Points. I don't think it's there anymore, above Pittsburgh in the middle of nowhere. And it was a big family. I believe his father was a carpenter, and he and his brother, maybe in their mid-teens, show up in a Pennsylvania census record living in another middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania working in oil fields. And this was not being rich and owning oil wells, this was being filthy, dirty, and digging, and being covered in crude. And that is how he got started. He was quite a worker, and he was a very good deal maker. And he was able to work his way up. And this is kind of interesting. I look for these weird little connections and wonder if they meant something at the time. The town in PA where he was doing some of his oil work was St. Petersburg, Pennsylvania. Very strange. And when I found that in a history book, I thought, that must be a mistake. I've never heard of that, but it is true. So that's kind of where he got going. I didn't hear a lot about him. My dad remembered him a little bit. He was a big guy, he was very tall, and he was loud, and he was a serious deal maker who got his way. So I'm going to cycle through these pictures, and as they inspire me to regale you with stuff I grew up hearing, I will do that. But that is the kind of, that's what his existence was for quite a while. That was him a little, he's actually prematurely balding. I think he's only in his 30s there. But these are taken from various books in Pennsylvania about oil people. That's a little bit later. So it's Perry Orville Lochner. Whoops, he's kind of rocking around. A little caricature of him, which I think it was, the book that was in was, I think these wealthy guys paid off the Pittsburgh newspaper cartoonists and came up with this idea to do this book as a cartoon of everybody. So it's fairly flattering. It's all right. I don't know if anybody, I hate to reference television in a history museum, but there was a television program maybe 15 years ago called Deadwood. Yeah, what a wonderful show. Anyway. In Deadwood, in the final season, Mr. Hearst comes, and he is supposed to be the man who can kind of hear the gold in the hills and knows where to dig. He says the Native Americans called him the boy that hears gold, I think. My great-grandfather seemed to know geology. He was fairly well-educated, but he never went to school for that. But he just had a knack for being able to recognize land that was probably going to produce oil and buying it and getting it at the right price. So that was kind of his gift. Because he had done so much work in the soil, actually, he was very good. I don't know if you're familiar with Pennsylvania geology, but it's all like slate. It can be very unstable. So when the Panama Canal was being built, he was one of the people that was hired to go to Panama and try and figure out what they could do to stop the sides of the dig from caving in at night. So that was kind of one thing he did. I believe, if I remember what my dad told me, this photo was taken on a family trip that they took after he was done in Panama, and I think it might be the Virgin Islands. So he's the guy with the dark sunglasses there, the kind of ominous looking one. And my grandfather, Einar Vinoy, is the young man on the right. That was one of our wells. I'm not sure where that is. But Perry and all his brothers were all involved in this. It was a very complicated. I've tried to figure out this company that they had, or them, multiple companies. It's opaque, and it's probably supposed to be. That's him a little bit later in life. I believe that was taken in Washington. So he had a home in Pittsburgh. He had a home in Washington, D.C., in Rock Creek Park. And he had a home here. I'm not sure if that's here or Washington. He worked as an oil industry lobbyist in Washington. At a point, and again, that St. Pete, PA thing ties into this. At a point, the family basically ripped up their roots in Pennsylvania right after World War I and came to St. Pete. That is his house in St. Pete. That house is still there. It was next to the mayor's house. It's on 13th Avenue Northeast, maybe at the corner of 3rd Street. It's a beautiful big place. That's another view of it. It looks that nice now. That's still pretty good. Now, I'd love to say, I think he was the driving force behind the hotel, because he did a lot of land development down here. The family built housing developments. There's a lot of stucco, deco houses up 13th Avenue Northeast that were built by the Lochners. This one being his nicest one. But I would love to say that once the hotel was built, he got to enjoy it for an immense amount of time and really savor his role as the king. But he did not. He was in his mid-60s. And in 1926, when the hotel had been open for 3 months, this is a lesson about going to the doctor. He got an inner ear infection that he decided he wasn't going to do anything about, and it only took about a month, and he was gone. So, in a very macabre joke, that's his house now. It's much smaller. Actually, Einar Vinoy's in there. It's, you know, very sturdy construction. There's a Tiffany window that sits in Pittsburgh. And I went to the office of the cemetery once and asked to know where my family mausoleum was. And the fellow opened a big drawer and just handed me a key. And I thought, I didn't really want to go in it. But I did. And so that is my whole family sitting there enjoying great-grandpa and grandpa's company. Those are the houses on 13th Avenue Northeast, at least some of them, and I know all those are still there because I've driven down the street and seen those. That was one of the many stock certificates for, I think, the Lochner Land Company was the facet of the business that owned couple thousand acres in Pasadena, maybe near a golf course. That's a family gathering. He's the big guy on the right with the cigar, also still looking kind of mad. And now here's an interesting story about him. This, my dad loved to tell this story. He worked on the oil exchange in Oil City, Pennsylvania, which was basically the stock market of the oil business, from 1882 to 90. And so my grandfather was actually born when they were there, when they lived in Oil City. And in school, my grandfather did something. I have no idea what he did, I never heard that, but got in a lot of trouble in school. The teacher had him put his hands on the desk and beat the back of his hands with a ruler that had a metal strip in it. So it sliced the back of his hands, which you could see, I guess, till the day he died, and then sent him home. So he went home to this 6 foot whatever man with a bad temper, and he was sure that he was just gonna get another beating for being a bad boy in school. My great-grandfather grabbed him and dragged him down to the school, and he thought, yep, he's gonna make me apologize. He brought him into the schoolhouse, let go of him, snatched up a slate off of one of the desks and went up and smashed it over the teacher's head and said, if you ever hurt my child again, it's going to be worse. So that's the kind of guy he was. So you can imagine in a deal situation, he's pretty good at the art of the deal, probably. So this is the business card. We're done with Perry. He's done. We leave him in that mausoleum. We're moving on. This is my grandfather's business card from the Vinoy. Not exceptionally creative, but it says what it needs to. Now, for somebody that lived that long ago, I'm going to play something for you now that is a very, very strange thing. And it actually has nothing to do with the hotel, except it's him. It's his voice. In going through my dad's things in his workshop, in his highly organized workshop, there was a box that contained spools with wire on them that you could use for, you know, like florist wire or anything like that. But there were a couple of them that were very peculiar. And as I showed them to someone, I found out that they were actually recordings before tape.
Wow.
So I found a wire recorder. These things were recorded on wire. And I played this recording. And it is a 1949 birthday party for my mother's grandparents. But the Lochners were actually there. I've never heard his voice before. So you're going to hear it now. And I should say that when I was growing up, my dad presented Imer Vinoy Lochner as a bit of a tyrant and angry and loud and harsh, difficult. And I think maybe their relationship probably had its ups and downs. And when I heard this recording, I thought, that isn't what he sounds like at all. So let's see if I can make this play without screwing it up. Where's the cursor? There we go. So it's just a funny, weird little snippet of a guy's voice that's been dead a long time. But it's actually him. And that's what he sounded like when he was over at that hotel, probably not yelling at people, like I was told. So, that's him as a boy in Pennsylvania. Another picture when he was a little older. He and my grandmother, this is funny, he was born in 1883 and so was she. They dated so long ago that their date photo was a tintype. So that's what that is, them on a date. The woman he married was named Stella Watson, my grandma. And in another kind of funny coincidence, her father had come to Pinellas County in the late 1800s. We think he maybe had orange groves, but we don't know exactly what he was doing here, him and a brother. And he ended up living down here apart from the family, and then he died here. So it's probably a good guess that the connection to moving here was that her father had been here, and they may have actually owned land here that I don't know about. But again, it's all it's impossible to figure it out. That was his first car, a 1908 Buick. I would have that now. I don't know where that car is. I never saw it. That's him being a dandy with a little mustache and a cigar, I see. My brother Vinoy did a little color work on that to make it stand out a little better. Oops. That's the house at 532 Beach Drive, right across from the Vinoy, the Jimmy Buffett Bed and Breakfast. My grandmother did not know whose car that was. It was just a car that was parked there. That wasn't their car. But it's kind of a cool picture, and it's another very nice car. That is the image of him that was done with color for the hotel when it opened. And during the period when the hotel had the historical section in the front, there was a copy of that up there. That is him and my grandmother in Maine with my dad and my aunt. My dad, I don't know exactly how old he was, but in the 20s he got polio. And it was the bane of his life for the rest of his life. But the family was told that it would be better for him not to be in Florida when it was hot weather and that they should get out. So they ended up hooking up with people from Maine and New Hampshire, and that's where they went. And they spent summers up there. So this is at a camp, it's called Lake Austin, Maine. I don't believe it's still there. But those were very good times for him. And those are the reasons that I ended up growing up in New Hampshire. Because for him, getting done with the real estate business in St. Pete and wanting out of the heat, it was pretty natural. That was his place. That was their chauffeur, Eddie, and one of their Cadillacs, and this was definitely during owning the Vinoy era, because that's a pretty nice car, and they're paying a driver. That is my grandfather on the right, and that is a fellow from St. Pete named Johnny Green, who I think took over. Is Rui still here?
Yes.
Did he take over for Tony Janus?
Yes.
Yes, he took over the air route for Tony Janus. Another aviator, so that's them in his airboat. Now, I love this one. During Prohibition, I'm sure you know where this is going. During Prohibition, my grandfather liked whiskey. During Prohibition, you really couldn't get it. So, they had an arrangement where someone from Cuba would come up and the stuff would be dropped in the bay, wrapped in shredded wood or straw, and all bundled up, and then an amount of time would elapse, and then he and his buddies would go out in this boat and pick it up, and I'm sure they turned it into the government. Now, one of my real glitches in talking to somebody important was when the hotel was being renovated, Fred Guest, the fellow who is responsible for it still being there, took me to lunch, and he wanted to talk about my grandfather. And I don't know. He asked, was he a patron of the arts? And was he a fan of opera or any of that kind of stuff? And I thought, oh, no. And he said, well, what did he like to do? And I said, well, his favorite thing was to go to his he had a friend whose last name was Bud, and it was being in the back room of Bud's drugstore, drinking during Prohibition and playing poker. And that's what he liked. And that was kind of the stupidest thing I ever did to somebody that could have bought and sold me 50 times. But, oh well, it was the truth. So this is on the Vinoy veranda. I don't think it's the opening, and I would say that it's a Spanish kind of themed party. My grandmother is the one who looks exceedingly proud that her husband owns the place. She would be she's got a large dark hat on, and she's got her hand on her hip. One, two, three, four from the left. And we had that was a shawl. We had that shawl actually for a long time. But looks fun. The fellow next to my grandfather is famous as a presidential candidate who did almost the worst in history, running against Franklin Roosevelt after his first term. But he was a family friend named Alf Landon. So that's my grandfather and Alf Landon going up the steps to the Vinoy. And I think George McGovern maybe did worse, but I'm not sure. My grandfather is the guy in the middle with his hands on his hips, and I believe that is that Al Lang? The skinny guy with the darker suit?
It is, yeah.
And it's a dirigible. I don't know any of the story of what that is or why that's there. Just an interesting picture. So as for family pets, when my dad was growing up, so my dad had white rats, they had dachshunds, they had a German shepherd, and they had a monkey, which is a very strange seems like a very strange thing today, but when I heard my dad talk about it, a lot of people in St. Pete had monkeys as pets. Very bizarre. Sounds illegal. There's my grandmother with the monkey's name is Mona. And then there he is with one of his dachshunds. The dachshund was named Vinoy, by the way. So, this was him as an old man, and this was not really very long before he died in 1961. It was the Festival of States Parade. It was hot out. He didn't want to get a sunburn. He didn't have a hat. He went in my grandmother's closet and got one of her hats. And somebody said something to him that you shouldn't wear a woman's hat out. And he was not somebody who gave a damn about what anybody else told him to do. And I think he probably relished it and thought it was funny.
Did he hit him over the head?
No. I don't think he did. No. No. So, now on to the gem of the evening. This was one of the original brochures. The title of this talk is taken from the idea about a wager or a bet being involved in the hotel being built and where it was built and all that, which maybe all of you have heard. I don't know. It's more complicated than that. This photo was taken from my grandparents' bedroom window looking down across the street at what was going to be the Vinoy. They did not own it yet, but it's not such a pretty picture that he took this picture because it was pretty and beautiful. It was because he was thinking about this place and this bit of land. I've had multiple people tell me that there had been all kinds of requests to buy this land and put a hotel up, but the only way it could be done is if they filled out into the bay, because it wasn't an incredibly wide plot of land, but it was surrounded by city land, and that made some kind of difference. I don't know exactly what that means. So how exactly did he get permission to do this? I have a guess. I think that a deal was cut where they would fill the land, and they would fill the land beyond what they actually needed. And then, as a thank you to the city, the end of that land would be donated to the city for a park. And I think that's probably, it's always a thing like that, I think. And I'm sure that's what it was, something to do with that. But it's not written down anywhere. And as I mentioned to somebody earlier when I was talking to him, my grandfather didn't save anything. He didn't give a darn about pictures or, you know, souvenirs, articles from when the Vinoy opened. He didn't care. He didn't do it. So it's all, but I think that's probably it. But the wager part of it is true. Even though it was prohibition, they had dinner parties in that house at 532 Beach Drive, and they involved a lot of liquor. There was a golfer named Walter Hagen, who was, I guess, maybe he's number three, I think, in history. Very interesting character, and he had some connection to kind of a crook real estate person in St. Pete named Jack Taylor, who built what is now Stetson Law School as a hotel that lasted 3 years because it was financially, it was a bad idea. So Hagen and Jack Taylor and my grandfather and some other people were at the house. I think after dinner, the ladies probably went and talked politely. I don't know. It's not Victorian, I guess. The gentleman went outside, and Mr. Hagen was demonstrating how good of a golfer he was. And that's dangerous when you've had five or six old fashions. But anyway, he was out there, and the bet was that he could drive a golf ball off of anybody's pocket watch, off the crystal, never touched the watch. He was perfect, and he was. And they drove the golf balls across the street into this piece of property. And then they went over and retrieved them. And supposedly, one of the guys that was there, probably in various shades of feeling really good, said, "Imer, you should build a hotel here. This spot's perfect, and you should use your name for it because Vanoy is such a pretty name." Well, he did do that, but I think he was probably already thinking about it. So there is where it came from. This is looking from the other side, probably down toward the yacht club. And as you can see, there is no land that sticks out where the Vinoy was going to be. This is before it was filled. This is the beginning of the dredging and the filling. And as you can see, like, they're building part of it, and then just behind it, they're filling the land. So it was like fast. The deal was this thing needed to be done in 10 months from nothing, because I don't know who decided it needed to open December 31st, 1925. It had to open. That was going to be the gala. And they did it. But this is kind of shows you there's like multiple things going on here. What a logistic nightmare. This is in my research for the little book my brother and I did. This was one of the best pictures I found. This is my grandfather, one of the people in the fedoras. It's hard to see because of where the break is. When I got a magnifying glass out and I looked at it, I realized that that's my dad standing in front in his little suit. And my dad did not ever live to see that. But he used to talk about when the place was being built and the dredges were running, his favorite thing when he got done in school was to go run through a hedge, go over there and get into the sand. He had buckets of arrowheads and all that kind of stuff dredged up in shark's teeth. And that was like, it was his greatest fun. So as a kid, that was a good deal. Just another shot of some work going on, a little further progression. Yes, how did it all come together? And you know, it's just as straight as it was the day it was built. It is something else. So this was a book that was published when it opened, and it details the people involved, and it talks about all the fittings and fixtures, and it's kind of like an advertising thing. Not necessarily for the hotel, but for like the mattress company and like the blanket company that made that blanket over on the table there and all that stuff. And these are some illustrations in it. They would have been before it was actually done. Very pretty. If you remember that fixture, you're going to see it later. And that one, that's in the lobby. The big window at the end with his name under it. So this is a program from the night the hotel opened. This was on display at the Vinoy a while ago. I took a picture of it. I'm a 35-year antique dealer, and I'm good at finding stuff. This is the only one of these I have ever seen, ever, anywhere. I would just pay through the nose to get one of these. But that's the opening night program. So let me tell you about opening night. As I said, it needed to be done. So things were rushed along. And I used to hear about this from my dad and my grandmother. When they opened the doors, New Year's Eve, December 31, 1925, immediately the place was set into running as though it had guests. So when the people came in for this gala, there were bellmen walking around paging people. And with a phone on a very long cord, walking around with phone calls for people that weren't there. Nobody was there. But it had to look like it was in full swing, full occupancy. And they went into the ballroom. And I know that there was wet paint. And a few days before the opening, they were laying the carpet. They wanted to lay the carpet in the hallways upstairs. And they found that the elevators were not strong enough to take the rolls of carpet up. And I remember my dad telling me that somebody thought of opening the upper doors and windows, and they did them with a block and tackle through the window, like length. Oh my God. So that's the stuff that was happening right up until the moment. One of the social mysteries that was purposely made a mystery was who the guests of honor were going to be of Mr. and Mrs. Lochner. Paul Whiteman's band was playing there, which was a big name. No one's ever heard of them anymore. But Bing Crosby started in Paul Whiteman's band. When the moment finally came for the guests of honor to come in, the guest of honor, the two of them, was my dad at 9 in a little tuxedo, and my aunt at 7 in a little beaded dress. So, and it's pretty interesting to have grown up with somebody that remembered that, walking into that room. And then the party probably went crazy after that. The man who was the manager the first year spent so much money that my grandfather absolutely hated him. He spent a crop load of money trying to get that place really, really looking good. And I think that probably was necessary. But Imer Lochner did not like that. So he fired him after the first season and then replaced him with this smiling fellow here who he brought down from Pennsylvania named Clem Kennedy. Now, I mentioned earlier to you how the hotel system worked at that time, where it was closed during the summer. When the Vinoy closed, all of the staff and the manager got on trains and went to Massachusetts. And then the hotel in Massachusetts opened, and they all worked there together. And then when it closed, they all came back down. Very, very strange, but whatever, it worked. That's a luggage tag. This was an ad from Time magazine. Right next to the plaza, that's pretty good. So this is Jack Taylor and his wife breaking ground for what he called the Rowlett Hotel, which was his name spelled backwards. Very humble man. The only people at the groundbreaking were my grandparents and the two of them. And as I recall, they encountered a rattlesnake on the way to the thing, and Mr. Taylor had a pistol and pulled it out and shot the snake. And that's what my grandmother remembered about that day. And as I said, that's Stetson Law School now. These are taken from postcards that came out when the hotel opened, so they're quite early. There's the lobby, the dining room. And there are those fixtures that you saw earlier in the opening catalog. The ballroom and the band stand where Paul Whiteman played, no one's ever heard of. This is probably from the 40s, and this is a fairly typical bedroom. When I was growing up, I had a twin bed in my room, and it was one of those beds. We had a lot of that furniture, and it was, you know, a little dated. You could also have your room turned into a two-room suite adjoining, and one of them had the beds out and turned into a little living area like this. So that's what this is. That is the front entrance, and if you'll notice what the fellow is wearing, it is the same as the coat right there. So that is the doorman's uniform from the early 30s, probably. I was told that if there was a cool morning, if you can you see it in this? The pillar to the right, there's a little thing on it, about head height. That is a big thermometer. And the instructions to the doorman were, if he came out and it was under 70 degrees, light a match and run the thermometer up, because when they come down, they don't want to see that it's 58. And suddenly, everybody was warm. So this is, I love this photo. As a military dealer, these are usually photos of soldiers all lined up. This is the Vinoy Bell staff. And the only reason we have this is when I worked there, when it was being renovated and reopened, when we did tours, a guy came in for a tour, and he was one of these guys. And he, just to the right of the break on the right, there's a guy with a big grin on his face, and that was the guy that gave me this picture. And then again, you've got the two guys at the end wearing that doorman uniform. The man on the other end was the bell captain. His name was McNichol. I don't know what his first name was. I only ever heard him called McNichol. He was from Scotland. He was just the bell captain. However, he was my grandfather's buddy. They loved each other. They got along great. McNichol, I believe, had a place out on St. Pete Beach, and my grandfather would go out there with a bottle of whiskey, and the two of them would sit in lawn chairs looking out at the water and the sunset, and I won't use a foul word, but there was an occasion where that fellow's wife called my dad and said, there's no way he can drive, you need to come and get him. And the two of them are about ready to fall over. So my dad drove out there, and while my dad was there, McNichol looked at my grandfather and said, you know what, Imer Vinoy Lochner, your problem is you're full of crap. And then I think realized what he had done and thought it was over. And after a few seconds, I think my dad said my grandfather just reared his head back and laughed and thought it was absolutely hilarious and wondered maybe it wasn't true. I don't know. But that was Mr. McNichol. I don't know who this guy is, but he's got a Vinoy Park Hotel hat on, and he's probably a limo driver. By the cars, I'd say the late 30s, early 40s. So now we're into the 50s and 60s. They put a swimming pool in the back that wasn't originally there. The hotel was originally going to be almost twice the size that it is. But then the land boom came to a halt, and then the Depression came, so there was just empty land, and it ended up having a swimming pool, a shuffleboard court. One of my mom's favorite stories was there was a man who owned the biggest match company in the Northeast named D.D. Bean. And Mr. Bean, what is that thing called that you push the shuffle? I don't know what those are called.
Tang.
What is it?
Tang. Like the orange drink, Tang.
A Tang. He leaned forward with the Tang and push the shuffleboard or the thing. You're gonna know what that is too. It's terrible, I don't know. I'm not from St. Pete. And it slid away and he just kept going. And he went right down and he was done. He passed away on the court in play. So there's that. So if anybody's worried about ghosts, I don't know, Mr. Bean was pretty wealthy. He wouldn't be a ghost that would haunt anybody, I don't think. Another shot of the Vinoy, nice one. So this is nearing critical mass. This has got to be the late 60s, and things were beginning to fall apart. It was not a good time. So I'd like to introduce you to the Vinoy as I remember it as a kid. And these pictures you're going to see were taken by me on one of the many times I pulled my way through the fence and went in, or paid off the guy that had the security trailer in back and he let me in. This is the front entrance, the grand front entrance. Tough to see. Hard to get through that without getting cut. The top picture is the ballroom when the hotel opened. The bottom picture is the ballroom as I saw it in 1981 or two. The top picture is the original dining room. The bottom is as it looked on that visit. And then the lobby. And there's those beautiful light fixtures. In the little book my brother and I did, I kind of mused in my head that it kind of looked like the catacombs. It was dark and clammy and awful and garbage and just, you don't want to know. There's the biggest tent in the world. I don't know how they managed to do that, but they did. I'm sure it needed it. So here we are finally in 1991-92. Stouffer went into a deal with Fred Guest. They did the work. They brought the place back. They didn't do everything perfect. But the alternative was rubble. And so my family was really very happy with it. And at that point, I began working there. And I think I was hired as a PR feature. Then they made me a concierge, and at a point I realized I didn't like working for anybody else. So this was a magazine that the hotel put out in about the first year that I worked on. And there's a copy of it over there, actually. They didn't continue that, but it was a fun little publication. That's a photo I took while I worked there, so that'd be 93. This was the opening day. That is the wonderful Mr. Guest on the left. The mayor on the right, his name may have been Fisher.
Yes.
Is it Fisher? And then the shorter lady is Jean Everett, who is Chris Everett's sister, and the other lady is Wendy Turnbull. So they had kind of demonstration tennis matches. My dad was honored to be the first guest of the newly renovated hotel, and Ms. Turnbull was the second. So, that's a different picture. So now, and when I'm done with this, I'm going to take questions. If you have any questions, doesn't matter what it is. Well, within reason. I want to tell you about the greatest thing Imer Vinoy Lochner ever did. Those people are actually my grandparents. And if you'll notice, that's not Imer Vinoy Lochner. That's my dad in the gentleman's arms. I hate to bring up pandemic, but in 1918 there was a pandemic. My dad and his sister and two older brothers were named Gibb, like Andy Gibb, the singer. And their parents, after Armistice Day for World War I, both got influenza. And they died within 4 days of each other. So that is my real grandmother, Amy Love McPherson, and my grandfather, Wharton Gibb. The best thing that Imer Lochner ever did was adopting my dad and my aunt, because there would be no me. When my dad had polio, Imer Lochner had the money to send him to Boston to get the most modern operation that would allow him to walk almost normally for the rest of his life, even though one leg was about 5 inches shorter than the other. And it hurt him, and he was embarrassed about it, but if he hadn't been with Imer Lochner, this wonderful grandfather in this picture worked for the railroad. That wasn't going to happen. Imer Lochner made sure that my dad and my aunt knew their real family, their real grandparents, their real brothers. He gave jobs to both of the brothers at the hotel, and they stayed in touch for the rest of their lives. So the hotel is wonderful. You can almost see it over there. The greatest accomplishment for us that he ever did was saving the two of them and giving us life. And that is all I got to say. What have I missed?
Questions? Also, your story is moving on many, many, many levels, so thank you. And we've spent a lot of time with the Vinoy, but we're sailors, so we stay at the marina. And then you get a lot of the privileges of the hotel, and you drink coffee on the porch, and you want to do the exhibits and the art. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the beauties of it, I think. And my question for you is, when you showed the pictures of the dredging, is that the Vinoy Basin?
If you picture the waterfront as you kind of see it here, running along there, and just picture it running straight right through the Vinoy and out the other side. That was the line. So there might be a tiny bit of the Vinoy that's actually on unfilled land, but the whole thing and the park at the end and everything is all filled.
What a gift.
I know, it's great. I like it. Yeah. Anything else? Anybody else?
One right there.
I'm not sure why there was a demise in the 60s after you survived the Depression.
Well, the kind of people who were the customers for that scenario I described to you, I mean, they didn't come for a week. Those people came for the whole time. In fact, there was a one guest that rented the whole floor that she was on. These people had a lot of money. I think they were kind of the descendants of people who had really struck it rich in the late 1800s. And by the time you reached the 60s, these people were elderly. Their kids were not interested in doing this kind of a thing. And just the whole scenario of the way the hotel worked. It just didn't work anymore. And there was no air conditioning. And maybe if they'd had been able to have it open all year, maybe, but probably not even that. And it became quite run down, and the man who bought it from us, my dad blamed him for this. I do not blame him. There was just not enough money to keep the place up. And he owned multiple places like this all over. And the same thing was with them. There was just no money. And he was himself in his 80s at that point. So I don't know if that answers your question. Yes, anybody else? Yes.
How much was it to stay a night when it first opened and then in the
1990s? And in what?
And in the 1990s, a room, how much did it cost to stay in a room when it first opened and in the 1990s?
The first part of that question I have to be vague about because I have a very vague memory of my dad saying it was $30 a night. But I don't know, and I'm sure people were given deals. When I worked there in the 90s, if you came at an off time, you could get it for $179 a night. If you came in like nice cool month like August. Yes?
It was an army hospital for a while.
Ah, yes, World War II. Let me tell you about World War II. World War II is what made my grandfather not want to own the hotel anymore. The government had the ability to kind of impress the facilities and pay whatever rent they wanted to, and they were taken over by the military, and it's fine, it needs to happen. And that happened to the Vinoy. So in 42, I believe, no more paying guests until 44 or 45. And I know that Air Corps guys stayed there. I know that it was used as a cook and baker's school because when I was doing those tours, I encountered a man who had been in the Merchant Marine and had been there in cook and baker's school. And he told me that they made so much steam in the kitchen cooking all the time, practicing, that the ceiling just was not accustomed to that. And at a point, part of it collapsed, and inside of it were all these cement bags that the people who laid at the floor or the ceiling had never bothered to take them out of the bag. They just threw them in the mix in the bag. And the old guy was very funny. He actually said, that was the best training for combat I ever got. So yes, and they tore it up. And then the government decided what they would pay for the damage. He ran it for two more years and then he sold it. And he was in his 60s. He didn't want to do that anymore. Well, yes?
Do you know what's going on with the Vinoy now and why it's not necessary to make these renovations?
Well, I do know some things about that. Because I talked to the general manager of the Vinoy who is sitting here. So I hope I'm going to say the right thing. I can tell you that renovation was done 30 years ago, the previous one. And any kind of a place that gets public traffic and the kind of use that the Vinoy has had, it kind of wears out. There was some updating done maybe 10 years ago, is that about right? More so, yeah. And so I think the new owner, Mr. Glazer, I've spoken to him. I think he's pretty interested in as much as possible of the place looking like it looked when it was new, while still being able to accommodate what people expect out of a kind of a top shelf hotel. So it's a, would you call it a renovation?
A sensitive renovation,
yes. And his ideas that he discussed were great. I think he really cares about it. His family has a lot of holdings that they own jointly, and the way he explained it to me was he wanted to own something in the community that was his, not his brother's, but his for his wife and new child, and that's the Vinoy. So I won't say no. Yes?
How much of the original light fixtures is left? I know a lot of it was sold off. And
every time, so after the hotel closed, the owner, what was his name? I can't remember the guy's name. Charles Alberding.
Charles, yeah.
He gave leases to people who had great plans where they're going to ride the back of the old hotel and they're going to get themselves rich. And every one of them failed. Every one of them failed. And when they were done, then they would sell pieces off to try and just recoup whatever money. And I believe in the end, even the copper wire was yanked out of it. Everything was scrapped. The light fixtures. The old lobby light fixtures maybe were still there, but I don't know. I think almost all of that was gone. I know there's collectors around here that I hear from them and they say, oh, I've got a light fixture out of the hotel in my living room. Oh, okay.
I can remember in the Evening Independent having these huge articles about selling.
Yeah.
You know, small fixtures, nothing huge. I don't remember the big ones.
No. There was a point where my dad and my brother Vinoy went down there and they were clearing the place out and they were selling the china in civil defense water barrels, 55-gallon drums full of china, $10, get the whole drum. None of the mermaid plates, though. And
I have one.
They let my dad and my brother were who they were, they let them walk around and they went down into an office in the basement of the hotel and it had been my grandfather's office. He obviously maintained his office even though he didn't own the hotel anymore, and there was a safe in there they'd broken open and all of his papers were there and drawings of him and all kinds of family stuff were still there, just scattered all over the floor. So he was pretty bright. He grabbed it all, my dad and my brother. But it just got worse and worse to where there was nothing left to sell. Yeah.
You sold it all.
Yes.
Kind of a curious question, but was your grandfather a golfer? Because it seems as though I know how Walter Hagen, great golfer, great drinker, but the stories that I've heard was it was a bet and somehow your grandfather was involved in a golf stroke and he perhaps lost.
I don't know. I don't know who the bet was with. I think maybe the bet might have been, I'll drive this golf ball off your watch, and if I break it, I owe you $100. My grandfather, I don't believe, ever owned a golf club. I don't think he had anything to do with that. No. That's an interesting thought, though. But no, I think it was just a bet of, I'm good enough that I can do this without wrecking your watch. At least that's as far as I know. Anybody else? Yes?
Maybe related to golf, I was wondering if you had any interesting stories about the history of the golf club.
The golf club, if you're all familiar with that, it's on Snell Isle.
Sunset
Golf Club.
Sunset.
Yep. In the early days of St. Petersburg and the land boom, there was what here was called the Pittsburgh Colony. And it was people from Pittsburgh that had a lot of money that had come here and did these amazing things down here. And it was like freewheeling. So a very good friend of my grandfather and great-grandfather was named D.L. Clark. And he owned Clark Candy, like the Clark Bar. And in Pittsburgh, he actually, I believe, owned and built the golf course and the club. And they had a reciprocal relationship with each other because they were friends. I know that when the Depression hit, my grandfather was in a bad position. And he had to borrow money from people. And one of the people he borrowed money from was D.L. Clark. And I always heard that was a $1 million loan on a handshake. Those guys didn't sign anything. It was done as a handshake. But D.L. Clark was the biggest loan he got to keep everything going because I think my grandfather's stocks all went down the toilet. So, yes. And they've always been connected. They've always had something to do with each other, now probably more than ever.
Yeah.
Yes?
Just wondering, your grandmother's house, where it was on the beach, in the Snell redevelopment that Perry Snell did. Do you know if there was ever any relationship between Perry Snell, who owned all the old Northeast, and your grandfather, and Snell Isle, of course, where the golf course is?
I don't know anything about that. I never heard Perry Snell talked about. My grandfather and great-grandfather owned land in Old Northeast, as I said, going up 13th. There's a couple developments way out that they owned, and then they owned a lot of land in Pasadena near the golf course. But I'd never heard Perry Snell mentioned. I heard a lot of names, but not his.
You might have bought it from him.
Maybe so. Who knows? Anything else?
You good?
All right.
Thank you very much.